session number 4617, room number 4.
Mr. Armand, Reel 4, did you have any air gunner duties at Mountbatten?
The air gunner's duties, firstly, as a crew member, then it was essential that you should be an air gunner as well. And the training was carried out on the unit by the flight sergeant. He was a senior armaments officer at the time, and it consisted of training in the Lewis gun on the ground, stripping and faults and reassembly, firing into the ranges, and also air firing. My position was in the front gun, and the Lewis gun was mounted on a scarf ring. A scarf ring was a steel ring which was adjustable for height and lateral movement as well, and the gun was mounted freely on this on the ring, and so it could be pointed in any direction. And the firing was when we did exercises. Once a year, we did 2 weeks. Summer training exercises. The whole squadron moved up to Tayport in Scotland, and we had fired on the sand dunes and at targets, RAFs targets affixed in the sea. We did our air firing at them. There was no air to air firing at all. Not for the flying boats, and although
what,
I believe,
why was that?
I don't really know why the flying boats. Whether the flying boats' duties were primarily patrol work, not defence work of any sort, simply patrol work, flying out to sea. So I suppose it was a secondary consideration. Really, after navigation. Anyway, I never did any air-to-air firing. We used to do bombing as practice for the air crew, the pilot, and this consisted of dropping small 11.5-pound practice bombs. We used to mount these on a small a bomb rack, which was fitted to the scarf ring at the mid position of the aircraft, and it used to extend out over the side of the hull. And we used to, one of the crew, or myself or the engine fitter, would fit one bomb at a time onto this scarf ring. I remember one occasion there was a sergeant pilot, Willits, and his electrical release for the bomb rack failed. So we rigged up a length of string from his position in the front back, and I was doing the loading of the bombs at that time. I was loading the bomb onto the bomb rack, and we tied a piece of string between him and my finger, and I would hold the bomb in my hand. After I pulled the pin out, the live bomb, hold it in my hand, and when he pulled the string, then I would drop it. I became quite adept at this, and after a while I found that I could in fact either hold back the bomb dropping for 1 or 2 seconds and perhaps get a little nearer than he could have done by by his own actions.
By his own signal?
Yes, by his own signal, that's right. Yes.
How long did you have between pulling the pin and the bomb exploding?
Well, that depended on the height, of course. Until the bomb struck something, it was quite safe. You could pull the pin and hold it indefinitely in your hand. Until the nose struck, then it was quite safe. That used to happen occasionally. Of course, the electrical equipment always, in those days anyway, it wasn't perhaps as reliable as it is nowadays.
How accurate could you be with bombing?
Well, I have seen them hit the target direct. We flew from at an height, I suppose, anything from 3,000 to 5,000 feet. Bear in mind what the era I'm talking about. Maximum speed 75 knots, and perhaps 3,000 to 5,000. Our maximum ceiling was only 8,000. It depends entirely on the pilot and his judgment of the crosswinds or whatever the wind may be, and aircraft speeds and so on. Reasonably accurate, I would say.
What were the main problems with using the Lewis gun in a flying boat?
Well, the main problems in those days were standing up in the slipstream. We had, of course, it was the gun was mounted on the scarf ring, and we were just standing up in the slipstream. And if you were behind the engines, as you would be in the mid positions, there were two gun positions in the midships and one in the front. And you had to be careful that you didn't shoot your own wingtips away. There were no limits on the movement of the gun, and also on the tail, of course, you had to watch what you were doing.
How did the slipstream affect you?
Well, mostly you had a pair of goggles, a leather helmet. We wore a leather helmet and a pair of goggles over our eyes, and. It was just the speed of the wind, really, that you had to become accustomed and judge by practice. You had to judge the amount of deflection you gave to your when you were aiming the gun.
Was the Lewis gun a reliable weapon?
Oh yes, most reliable weapon, and the stoppages which one got. Were known stoppages and a recognised procedure which you could adopt quite quickly to clear a gun.
How quickly would you be able to clear a stoppage?
Well, unless a bullet was absolutely jammed in the barrel, you could clear a stoppage inside a minute, I would say. Occasionally there was you'd get a faulty bullet which would jam in the barrel, and then you just had to bring it down, leave it, but otherwise you could do it fairly quickly.
Were you under any instructions about jettisoning bullets from the gun out of the plane?
No, your bullets were mounted in a drum, a detachable drum. So when you're loading, each drum, I think, held 100 bullets, and these are 303, and you had I think on the Southampton there were 5 drums to each gun, and they were fastened, clipped on the side. So you pressed one of the buttons, and the pan came off, and you just slapped it onto the gun, and loaded the trigger, and with a handheld cocking piece, and the gun was ready to fire. And when you're unloaded, if you didn't finish the full drum, when you're unloaded, you would take the pan off and then just hold the gun out to sea and just press the trigger until it emptied itself. And then you would cock and see that it's empty, and then bring the gun inboard again. You'd dismount the gun from the Lewis from the scarf ring.
Whilst you were at Mountbatten, did you ever receive any lectures about what the function of flying boats was in the RAF at that time?
No. The only lectures that we had, which were, if I may quote, King's Regulations, Sections 4 to 44, which were read monthly. And these dealt with discipline, and discipline in the field in the case of war, and those sections. And those were the only lectures that we had dealing with the service side of things. There were educational facilities education officers, and we were and trade training facilities, of course, for those who needed to take trade tests. The educational side of things, there was the higher educational test, part one, part two, and part three, and part three was equivalent to the matric side of school education. These were voluntary, of course, and most of it was done in your own time.
Did any special events occur whilst you were at Mountbatten, apart from the summer training camp, or was it all routine?
No. The routine were mostly navigation trips, when we would go out and perhaps do a navigation trip to Ushant, to Scilly Islands, where we would land, and back to Plymouth, or to cross to Jersey or Guernsey, to a point on the French coast, and then back to Plymouth. That sort of navigation trips. And one period during would be June 1934, early 1934, the whole squadron went up to Calshot, and we did 3 weeks of exercises on testing a new system of sound detection, where each of our boats went out one by one, and we flew a zigzag course and landed at Calshot, and there was a sound detection at Dungeness, and it was their job to track our course. And after we would land we'd take off from Calshot, we would do this exercise and land at Dover, stop overnight there, and then the next day fly back a different course again back to Calshot. These trips would be about 4 to 5 hours and of duration, and the army, I think, and the experimental people were doing these had this sound detection equipment at Dungeness. That was one sort of exercise that we did. We had the royalty came down, the Prince of Wales on one occasion came down and was going to visit the Scilly Islands. I was very excited because I was at that time the airframe man on the CO's aircraft, our squadron CO's number one, and he told me that, told the sergeant, the flight sergeant rather, in charge of the squadron, he told us to prepare his boat for the Prince of Wales. And on the night before the trip was due to take place, We went around and did a last inspection, and my fitter found a cracked engine bearer, a wooden engine. These are two wooden engine bearers, and he found one of them cracked. So, without any more ado, we set to, lifted the engine out, and worked all night, and refitted a new engine bearer. This was a bare bearer. All the holes had to be drilled and reamed out. Another wooden hose, but we also had to be a very tight fit for the bolts going through. And the engine replaced and then taken out and tested again, which we were doing just as it came to daylight, and said, right, we're ready. But our squadron commander thought he had been kind to us, and he said, well, you've worked very hard, and now you need to go to sleep. You take the day off now, and I'll get another crew. We were very disappointed, of course, because, well, after all, we don't fly the Prince of Wales around every day, does one? So I didn't take part in the trip eventually.
On the sound exercise you mentioned, mm-hmm. was the idea to rather like radar, to be able to detect the position of that's planes by, yes. by the sound of the engine?
That's right, yes.
How far out were they hoping to detect the sound?
Well, I don't really know. We were well out of sight of land, of course, but we flew at different heights, and it was a zigzag course, and I don't know what the other... bear in mind that I was only a lowly airman, of course, perhaps even the officers, the pilots wouldn't necessarily know what it was all about. They'd be just given their course and track to fly, you see. But I know it was experimental equipment at Dungeness. There's another exercise too. In fact, I have a photograph somewhere. We did some original supply dropping, and what this amounted to was a waterproof box was manufactured, and a parachute attached to it, and this was then hung on a bomb rack underneath the wing, and we flew off with the intention of dropping this supplies by parachute. Very early days of supply dropping. Another occasion, we also did refueling at sea. That was a very rough episode. We landed outside in the channel, and reasonably calm according to the naval, but our little boat was quite rough, and the ship was steaming along. I can't remember what size ship it was. It was a big one, but and they trailed a line in the water, which I picked up and then pulled it in, and along came a hose, and we refueled the tanks at sea.
How did you pick it up?
Well, they trailed a line in the water, you see, and as they were steaming along, and we come up behind it with the engines running, and I picked up this line
just with your hand?
With a boat hook. Mm. And then pull the line in. It would float, you see, it would float on the water, and pull the line in, and eventually came a hose pipe out. Yeah.
So it was a successful exercise, was it?
Oh, yes.
What were the flying conditions like in the Western Approaches area for flying boats?
Well, quite reasonable, I suppose. The sea was normally, when you get away from the land, there was normally big swells, but on the whole, we quite reasonable. I've landed in the Bay of Biscay, in the middle of the Bay of Biscay, and taken off again without any problem.
Even whilst there were swells?
Oh, yes, while there were swells, yes.
So a flying boat could land in quite rough seas?
Reasonably rough seas, yes. Yeah.
How could you tell whether it was safe to land? Just by visual judgment?
Mostly by visual judgment, yes. And you knew the wind force, of course, you'd check the wave tops. You could see the wave tops as well. You might have a swell running one way and the wind the other way. And of course, well, then the pilot would use his own judgment and perhaps he would land across the swell rather than with it. Didn't go down unless you felt it was safe, unless you absolutely had to, which was the case of that one which I mentioned in the first place, which had landed and had got smashed up.
Can we go on next to how you left Mountbatten? How did that come about?
Well, there was, in those days, when one did a tour abroad, the trooping season was during the winter. It started in October and finished in April. And you were usually given a warning during the summer. And I remember that my warning came through when I was up at Tayport on the air gunnery exercise in the August. And I was warned that I should be going abroad. And I had to go along to see the doctor and get vaccination and inoculation. The vaccination against smallpox and inoculation was against typhoid and tetanus. Shouldn't really, I found out to my pain and discomfort that the two shouldn't be administered together. But this medical officer, he gave me the inoculation in one arm and vaccination in the other arm at the same time. And one fought the other and I had two very bad arms. And in fact, I was still had very bad arms when we were due to return and to Plymouth. And my flight commander said, well, if you like, would you care to go back by train or fly back? Well, it was 24 hours by train or it was 10 hours flying. And I said, well, I'd fly back. And a very painful 10 hours that was. We landed at Felixstowe. My fitter, fortunately for me, he did the mooring, so I had nothing to do, but both my arms were very swollen and I had big lumps under them as well. So, but that was early days. We didn't very often have that sort of mishap. After that, we were issued with our extra uniforms and the extra clothing for abroad were a Wolsey helmet with a what do you call the
puggery?
The puggery that went around and a flash that went on the side. There were very long shorts which came down to the knee, two pairs. There were shorts, a pair of black shoes, a button-up tunic, thick long johns, woolen long johns, in case you got cold in the winter, and thick woolen vests as well, and a spine pad. And and an extra kit bag to carry all this extra clothing. That I would be an issue when I returned to base. And I left there and went to October, I think. Yes, it would be October.
Which year was this?
In 1934. And went up to Southampton on my own, where there was the troop ship was an RAF troop ship. We had our own troop ships in those days, and one or two, I think two before Christmas and two after Christmas. This was the Lancashire, and we sailed from Southampton and called at the various bases on our way. On board the troop ship, we were given a hammock and shown how to make up the hammock and where we should hang it. And each allocated to a troop deck where we ate and where we slept at night. The hammocks were long, hung on two hooks. We were all tightly packed. And our duties were did guard duties during the trip. When we were given a rifle and had to stand on sentry duty at various strategic points throughout the ship. My name beginning with A, and I was always one of the first, any sort of duty that came along, I was one of the first to go on. And so I was on duty the first night, and I remember that, as we were going through the bay, my position was down on this guard duty, was down in the married quarters. Now, on board these troop ships, there were certain bunks and things for families. Husbands were, the families would travel on the same boats as the husbands, but they weren't allowed to, the husbands weren't allowed to travel with the families. So the wives were in cabins, and wives and children, but the husbands slept with the, and
single men.
With the single men, you see. And I was on duty down in these in a long passage with the doors opening out in these cabins as we were going through the Bay of Biscay. Very rough night, and I was standing there with a bullet, with a rifle, no bullets, just a rifle. I suppose that was to lean on in case I went to sleep or something. And it was very rough, and I remember the doors opening and wives opening the doors and saying, "I'm going to die, where's my husband?" And you know, real rough, seasick episode. But other than that, we had ship's rounds in the morning when the ship was all tidied up and decks scrubbed and ship's shape. And after that, we simply played tombola. To pass the time away, and we called it Gibraltar, we called it Malta, we called it Alexandria. And then as we went down the Suez Canal, I remember we put white canopies were put up over the decks to keep the sun off. And as we went down the sea, it was very, very hot, and the pitch in the between the board, the decking all melted, you know, and in spite of the canopies, and we all found we were getting bits of tar on our new uniforms. And that was our first introduction to heat. We stopped at Aden, where we took on water and refueled more coal. And there were these bum boats, which are, of course, were the natives with duty-free goods, which seemed to be absolutely ridiculous in price in those days. More so now, I suppose. And then after we left Aden, we went up the Persian Gulf. And when we got at Kuwait, we moored overnight, and then went up the Shatt al-Arab at dawn the next morning.